What I like to do is first lay down a kind of syncopated beat that isn't so much about what it is altogether. It's more about the modulation and what it is once it starts. It's a little bit of a groove more than it is a rock beat. I do a flam rest, flam rest, flam rest, followed by sort of kind of an intricate African thing on the low drums. So it goes like so. The pattern is you ride on this tom here. Hopefully you've got the 17 toms. And it goes something like this.
TBTL.
Luckily for me, I've processed all my feelings. And I've gone through the 5 stages of grief. Denial, anger, internet commenting, cat adoption, African dance, cat returning to the adoption place, watching all the episodes of Murphy Brown, and not giving a flying fart. How many stages is that?
She was a shake dancer. She did the hoochie cooch.
I'm just trying to figure out why you would do this. Why anyone would do this.
The reason anyone would do this, if they could, which they can't, would be because they could, which they can't.
I don't believe you're seriously considering listening to these men.
Feast your ear tongues on these memory pops.
Well, hello, good morning, and welcome to a Monday edition of TBTL, the show that just might be too beautiful to live. My name is Luke Burbank. I am your host, coming to you today from the Cleve in the shadow of 5th Third Bank, just off of St. Clair Avenue in downtown Cleveland, Ohio. It's episode 2919 in a collector series, and we have much to talk about on this Monday, including news that Burger King, a.k.a. Burure, a.k.a. Hungry Jack's, has been sending out real steamed hams, real meat burgers in Brooklyn, and trying to pretend that they're fake meat burgers. What a world we live in where that's what's actually going on. I also overheard a couple of people last night talking about the big bucks to be made in the fake meat market space. So I guess everything's coming up vegan. Anyway, we'll tell you the story on what happened with that. Also, the FCC has allowed cell phone carriers to actually block robocalls instead of just telling you that this might be a spam call. Instead of just alerting you visually to it, they can now actually block them. And there's a dazzling deet in this article that makes me realize I have not lost my damn mind, which is always a relief. Also, we'll say goodbye to Bushwick Bill from Ghetto Boys. Last Halloween fell on a weekend. Me and Ghetto Boys was trick-or-treating. interesting note about Bushwick Bill's recent name change that I think is something that maybe we should have Andrew go by. So we'll talk about that too, plus emails and V-mails. Speaking of Mr. Andrew Welsh, the longest-running co-brogan of the show, known for his drawings of tall ships, their grace, and their majesty, he's ready to ziggle and zag it and really just get at it. He's in the Roosevelt neighborhood of Seattle, Washington right now. And it's time for him to start talking. Good morning, my friend.
Good morning, Luke. I'm excited. So you're in downtown. You're not way out in like Wycliffe or Mayfield or wherever you're going to be, way out on the east side in Cleveland. You're getting to enjoy the splendor of downtown Cleveland. I'm not being sarcastic when I say that.
I am downtown, and I am enjoying the splendor of Cleveland. In fact, recently, as in, I don't know, 10 hours ago, I found myself pulling over to get Waze working on my phone, because I was in Cleveland. I just had a lovely dinner at a place called Town Hall, which, by the way, specializes, Andrew, in vegetarian and vegan fare. So that's probably not the Cleve that you grew up in. And I was pulled over, and I was trying to get the mapping software working, and I looked over at a beautiful campus of a high school, which was, in fact, St. Ignatius.
Ah, I know it well. I know it well. So how did you end up in this area? Were you doing work downtown?
No, I was actually doing work out in Chardon, Ohio. And sometimes when people have a bad stomach, I knew
we couldn't.
Also, you're stuck
you said that.
You're stuck with this with this series of sound effects because right before the show started, the listeners will, I hope they're sitting down. There's an issue with a mini-to-mini cable here in Cleveland. I had to, my cable that plays the sound effects or allows me to play the sound effects apparently burned out. So I'll see if I can get a new one in Austin later today. But I do have my sound machine. And so I can at least do this. And I do apologize for making a Who Chardon reference. Anyway, I'm doing this story in Chardon. I went to a surprise wedding yesterday, Andrew, where the people showing up at the wedding did not know that it was a wedding, that they were coming to an engagement party. And so we were there filming it. But I need to go to the airport after this. And so it made the most sense, I thought. And let's be honest, I just like downtown Cleveland more than the exurbs of Cleveland. So I'm staying downtown right now.
Oh, nice. Okay, good. Yeah, no, I'm glad to hear that because I know the last week you were thinking that you were going to be staying out on the east side, which is, you know, no offense to the east side. I of course, you know, west sider, and there is a divide there, a gulf between the east side and the west side. I tend to think of the west side as the best side, mm-hmm. But no offense to the east side. But if you're going to visit Cleveland, especially for a just short little jaunt like that, it's best if you can get right there downtown. Because I'm telling you, you can get some beautiful sunrises, some beautiful sunsets, some beautiful views of the Cuyahoga or/and. I'm doing like a Chili's thing. They're not a bar and grill. They're a grill and bar.
Mm-hmm.
Lake Erie as well. So good on you.
Yeah, I didn't know this, that there's an airport on the lake. I did not land at that airport, but that was interesting.
Burke Lakefront Airport?
That would be the one.
That's where you and I are going to go to watch the annual Skyjinks show. Yeah, they have an air show there. I assume they're still doing it. I used to go to it as a kid. Blew my mind. I seriously want to go back to that.
That sounds amazing to me because what a cool spot to be sitting just looking out on Lake Erie. Mistake on the lake. Yep. Yeah, right. To be looking out on the lake and then be watching an air show over it. That's ticking a lot of boxes for me. So yeah, I would totally do that. I am really digging downtown Cleveland. There's a lot of cool architecture down here, and I have to say the Indians were playing here, and everybody was excited. I was listening to the game on the radio yesterday, and it was an interesting experiment to listen to a baseball team that is capable of winning and not even not losing at such a catastrophic level that they also lose in milking contests before the game, as you informed me and the fun-loving criminals via text. What happened to our beloved Mariners? They were losing at every single aspect of the game this weekend.
Yeah, and then they apparently, of course, you got to give them credit. They did blow the Angels out of the water yesterday. I literally won, well, we shouldn't get into this, literally won our first series in over a month yesterday. So congratulations to the Seattle Mariners. You still got pluck.
Slow clap.
But please clap. But yeah, then I think it was, I mean, it's been a rough road for these Mariners. I mean, I was not really following them closely when we were in Australia. I mean, enough to know that things weren't going great until I kind of came back this last week and really sat down to watch some Mariners games and look at what has happened. I mean, if the wheels came off this bus, I mean, I'm surprised there were ever wheels on this bus. I don't remember what wheels look like or even what buses look like anymore. So the
like
Mariners,
the old kids
bad,
song,
bad
the
place.
Wheels on the bus are non-existent.
Exactly. And then they had what? Like some sort of a pre-game. Was this at Safeco or another? Or was it when they were out in Anaheim? There was like some sort of a pre-game, let's all have fun milking competition where representatives of the Mariners team went out and competed against, I believe, representatives of the Angels. And
this sounds 100%
game,
like a tie-in from the American Dairy Association.
Yeah. Yeah, I think so. It was military milk your cow night, I believe, at Anaheim
it was
Stadium.
Military cows don't impact for a day, but for a lifetime.
But for a lifetime, yeah. Anyway, the Mariners apparently got smoked in the milking contest as well. God. So,
yeah. Well, it's been great being here. And the stadiums, I have to say. Oh, I got excited, Andrew, because not to make this all sport talk, but just, you know, Cleveland Browns imagery everywhere because of being in Cleveland, and it's exciting. They're going to be a good football team this year, I think. Stadium, cool looking. I like how both of the stadiums are perched right along the water, or at least close to the water here, right in the heart of the city. They're not, you know, shipped out to some exurban location. Where you have to sit in traffic to get to them. You can sit in traffic right here in Cleveland and go to them.
Yeah,
and then,
right.
And then I at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, which, no offense, but I question the premise of having a Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. I don't know who gets to decide who gets in there and all that. But because I.M. Pei recently passed away, and he's the person who designed the pyramid, the kind of shape of the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. It took on a new dimension for me because I didn't know it was designed by I.M. Pei until he passed away, and that was mentioned.
Oh, I didn't. Honestly, I didn't know that either. I knew that it was a architectural. It was of some architectural significance. Yeah. I have not. I'm like you. I have not darkened the door of the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. I mean, whether it's a Hall of Fame or a museum, which I guess that's both, or even the Experience Music Project here, which is now called MoPop or whatever. Like, I have been to MoPop a few times, and I know I've said this a million times, but this idea of just kind of like walking through halls that feel like they're just imbued with importance, but you're looking at Kurt Cobain's report card and you're right. Just like, I don't know. Like, I got C's too.
Right.
I mean, I don't know. Like, it's hard for me to kind of like, it feels like a juxtaposition in my head between the way things are sort of presented and with such importance. I'm like, yeah, but also that's just a roach of a marijuana cigarette. Like, I don't care that Jimi Hendrix might have touched it once.
Right. Mo pop, mo problems, as they often say.
They often say that.
Yeah, I'm with you on that. Like, I actually said the same thing about sports to you while we were on one of our many, many hour drives in Australia, which is, I don't really, it's weird, I don't understand the fetishization of former athletes, which really is bad. It means that I just am extracting the value from this human being as far as they're good at hitting baseballs or at dunking basketballs or at catching touchdowns. And then when they're done, it's like I don't wish them any ill, but I don't have an emotional connection to them based on what they did because they're no longer able to do the thing that made them interesting to me. And there's something sort of like that with music. I'm with you. Like, I just – and I've hosted a number of events actually when it was EMP – where it was all about, like, I'm going to touch this guitar that was once held by Jimi Hendrix. And it just, that was just never something that really connected for me. And the same thing goes with sports memorabilia. I don't know. It just doesn't, like, to me, it's like a baseball bat that was used for something important is now just a piece of wood that is sitting there. And it's kind of, I guess, notable and cool, but it doesn't get me excited the way it gets some people excited. As you would suspect walking to the Cleveland airport where every single ad is of Eddie Van Halen jumping because of the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame being here.
There is a cool little History of Superman exhibit in the Cleveland Hopkins International Airport. I realize I am not usually a big Cleveland booster, but I do feel today like I have a little tidbit. You know what it is? This is a weird thing. It's a beautiful day here. It hasn't been last week. I think it was kind of rainy, a little overcast. We had a nice weekend here weather-wise. Right now, it's a beautiful morning. The sun is coming, and it really feels like early summertime, like sort of imbued with summer right now, and those summer feelings. And I think that you being in Cleveland, I'm picturing Cleveland in this weather. That's a very weird thing to admit, but like I think if it was a rainy day here, I'd picture you in rainy Cleveland, and I wouldn't be like as kind of giddy about this whole thing. But now I'm picturing you in a sunny, beautiful Cleveland downtown area, and I'm not jealous necessarily, but I'm glad you're there, and I'm glad you're taking it in.
Would it make you feel less jealous if I told you that it's currently downpouring outside here?
Is it really?
Yes.
Is it?
It is. Ooh. Yeah, it is wet and crummy here, and I'm not trying to break up your kind of vision
of
this place.
But,
oh, that's all right.
No,
I'll soon be in sweltering Austin. So
yeah.
The good news for me is wait 5 minutes and the city I'm in will change if you don't like the city.
Hey, hold on 1 second. Can we go back to something, though? You were talking about you and I pretty much agreeing that not feeling like something that was touched by a famous person is hallowed or, you know, maybe celebrating these post you know, career athletes, et cetera. Is there anything, though, in your life, whether it's in a different realm, like a professional realm, where, you know, I don't think this is the example that would work, but like some Edward R. Murrow microphone. Is there anything anywhere, or to go back to music, like if you, I mean, if you had a chance to own a Jeff Tweedy guitar, I assume that would hold some appeal to you. Like, is there anything that you can see yourself geeking out on?
You know, maybe if I could get one of my daytime Emmys that I've, by the way, recently won another one as a part of CBS Sunday Morning. And I say won in that the email they sent out was to about 120 people. Mm-hmm. So I am on a list of 120 people who technically qualify for that award. And, you know, I guess if I could have one of those, that would be cool to me because they're $400 to $500. Actually, I got to give credit to the woman who handles. Let me see if I can find this for you real quick, Andrew. This is a woman who's actually our fact checker on the show. Her name's Kathy Lewis. And this is the note that she sent out. Let me see if I can find it. To congratulate all of us on winning a daytime Emmy. Here's what she writes. Congratulations again on your daytime Emmy win for Sunday Morning. Outstanding morning program. Thanks for being patient about the instructions for ordering. If you are receiving this email, you are now eligible to spend $510 of your own money on an Emmy statue. CBS does not pay for this.
So it's kind of written in the same tone as don't forget to fill out your timesheets.
No, but I mean, I think she's probably been writing a version of this email, you know, for 10 years. And before that, she was probably writing a memo and having it sent around because the show, let's be honest, I think it's probably a fairly limited category of best morning program. They win it every year. And I like that she's like, you have now won the right to pay a bunch of your own money for a statue thing. Like, it doesn't feel like a... doesn't feel mean-spirited. It feels like she's kind of recognizing the absurdity of the whole thing. So, like, if I could get one of those and not pay the money for it, that would I would like that. Because as I've already established on the show, I would like someone to walk into my office in Burbank Springs and see an Emmy on a shelf and think that that means that I am more valuable as a person. I would like that scenario to unfold. But apparently I don't care enough to actually buy it, slash also my embarrassment – because I've talked about the fact that you have to pay $510 for it. Like if you walked into my office and saw it, your first thought would not be, hey, my friend Luke Burbank, he's a valued journalist. You would be like, oh, wow, Luke actually broke down and paid the money for that because he's that insecure.
Honestly, I'd probably just think, where's Rudy? I mean, if I'm being 100%.
You're like, actually, did Rudy touch Rudy this daytime Emmy more? At any point? Was this the last daytime Emmy that Rudy owned?
Right, right, exactly. Do you think Rudy would respect you more, your dog?
I can't even begin to try to unpack what's going on in that dog's brain, Andrew. She's been regressing lately when we go places and take walks, but it just makes no sense. We'll walk by a pack of dogs and she'll have no reaction, and then she'll see a deflated Mylar balloon that says happy birthday, and she'll lose her mind and go try to attack it and drag me with her. Like I can't begin to understand her brain.
Okay. Well, either way, scratch her behind the ears for me when you see her next, which will be after Texas, I assume, right?
Yeah.
Texas,
here's the, here's the schedule after a couple things after Texas. So, tonight I'm going to Austin, and then tomorrow I'm going to interview. So this story that I'm doing for CBS is about surprise weddings, which kind of sounds silly, but if you remember when I was here previously and I talked to you about it, I think you agreed that it actually makes a little more sense when you hear the explanation of why anyone would do this. Oh, but I got to – you know what? Let's do this, Andrew. Let's take a quick break, and then I got to tell you something that happened at this thing that was a little realer than I was ready for. I'll get into that right after this break. This is TBTL. Stay with us. Michael Stanley, I presume.
If you please. That's right. Cleveland's own Michael Stanley. I think there was a lot of pride around Michael Stanley in Cleveland
at
one point.
I like that
somehow.
Song that I was hearing.
I don't dislike it. I mean, with the horn, I have never heard this song before. I just kind of chose it. It's his most popular song, apparently, according to Spotify. But, well, I mean, those horns come in, and it's definitely, you know, evocative of the
inspired.
Boss. Yes.
Somebody wrote on
but
Twitter.
But then it becomes like the Cars, sort of, like here. But.
Somebody wrote on Twitter, like, approach life with the enthusiasm of Bruce Springsteen counting to four.
Yeah. Very good.
I asked you to select a little Michael Stanley, the pride of the Cleve, or at least the region, because I was telling you that during the break that when I was driving around yesterday in the rental car, I just let the station scan. By the way, I was doing some power listening to WKSU. Your old
oh, yeah.
stomps. I took a picture of WKSU on my radio to send to you. I don't know what you would do with that
oh.
information, but I just wanted you to know that I was enjoying a radio station that does feature a photo of Andrew Walsh in its Radio Hall of Fame.
Yes, which I'm sure still exists.
Then
that piece of paper that somebody taped to a wall.
I believe it was
laminated,
ago. Okay? So don't sell yourself uh-huh. short. And then I just the radio stopped on some station that was playing kind of like, imagine music that sounds a little bit like Foreigner or just that kind of mm-hmm. 80 Night Ranger, just like 80s rock. But it was all songs that I had never heard before from bands I had never heard before, but that sounded exactly, it was like that way that Michael Stanley song sounds exactly like a Bruce Springsteen song, at least at the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
There was the kind of like, I guess you would say butt rock version of that. That I heard like three or four songs, and that's what I should have been taking photos of, not WKSU's logo, but whatever those songs were called, because they were like, yeah, it was mystifying to me because I kept waiting for it to get to the part that I recognized, and it never did. It was just like this odd, just like weirdly specific Cleveland version of all this music.
Now, my guess is, and I mean, there's no way to figure this out for sure. My guess is, the first thing I think of is it might be 98.5, which according, I wouldn't have known this off the top of my head.
Logos, like the drone or something? I feel like there was it started with a D.
Wow,
station.
That's interesting.
The drop, maybe? Is that a thing?
I'm on their website, which is a jankyradio.com website, but it's 98.5 WNCX, Cleveland's Classic Rock. I'm trying to figure out,
it's supposed to be.
Okay, we're in a commercial break right now.
If it's in a Tom Shane ad right now,
I
swear to God.
Oh my
you're
God.
Amazing.
Wait 30 seconds. Yeah. So on the air right now is a guy named Bill Lewis who's spinning records, and he looks exactly like what you'd expect a DJ, like a mid-afternoon DJ to look like on this station. He looks like he's about probably, I'm going to say 58 years old, has longish hair, but it's only on the back half of his head, a 70s-esque mustache, and wearing a station's polo shirt. He looks like somebody who would be very into Michael Stanley, and right now he is spinning. But again, are we in a commercial break?
Soylent is feel-good food.
Yeah, we are.
Wow.
For Soylent. So,
welcome to 2019.
Yeah, let's keep that running in the background.
Soylent
yeah.
is feel-good food.
Yeah.
San Francisco has recently banned Face ID technology. Brought to you by Soylent is feel-good food. Oh, cool. Right. Well, let's just go to the outback of Australia and drive around running out of petrol so we can fully just embrace the dystopian future.
Have you been convicted of a crime you haven't committed yet? Call this number.
On the subject of which, I really, Andrew, I'm sorry, but I have to implore you, if you have not actually gone back and finished, I think you should leave now, the Tim Robinson thing on Netflix. I implore you to reinvestigate it, because I started following a Twitter feed that's just write lines from that show. And I was on the airplane, and I would just see a line about like TC Tuggers, those shirts that have the handle on them so you don't ruin your shirt or hurt yourself by pulling them out. And they'll just be like, but they're not a joke. You don't give them as a joke. You don't wear them as a joke. They're not like a Snuggie. And like, I'll just see that line and just remember when Tim Robinson said it on the show. And I'll just start, I was like cry laughing on the airplane just at the reading of a line from the show.
There's something about that show. I was talking about it over the weekend, telling somebody about it who hadn't seen it yet, but who had heard it or heard of it. And I just don't know that I've seen a show have this sort of impact on the culture? I mean, and I don't mean that like it's the biggest impact a show has ever had on the culture, because clearly it's not, and it's more of a subculture and the people who share our kinds of sense of humor. But to just go from me never having heard of it, which, okay, that's not the rarest thing, but it was pretty new, and you saying, we were in St. Paul, you're like, oh, I watched this show in my hotel room last night, binged the whole thing, and I'm just obsessed. You told me about it. And I feel like within, I don't know, 48 hours of that first conversation, suddenly every single person who, again, shares our humor or worldview or whatever was just going flipping crazy. It was just, it was like wildfire. It was like that green fire in Game of Thrones. It just took off. And it also, you're right, it has that staying power. You just get one line in your head like an earworm, and it just, it can make you giggle out of the blue. And I know we're not alone.
Yeah, it's really, you're exactly right. Like, it, I can't think of, maybe Key and Peele, but the thing is, it's, media is so different now in how it is released to us, because Key and Peele, you still had to watch it week in and week out. Or maybe like Chappelle Show, like the playing basketball, you know, the Charlie Murphy sketches. But even those, mm-hmm. it was like one thing, and people won't be talking about, you know, Prince or whatever, like in the, you know, Dave Chappelle playing Prince. But it just, it isn't like, what's interesting about the Tim Robinson show, which does actually feature Tim Heidecker, is that they dropped the whole season at once, as is typically the case with Netflix. And so everybody probably has a different favorite. People who really like that series have a different favorite sketch. And so I don't know. I just feel like there's a bunch more sort of contact points with the show. Mm-hmm. And so maybe that's also kind of adds to how everybody in our friend group is talking about it. Also, apparently, here are the people I follow exclusively on Twitter. It is a Venn diagram that is a perfect circle. It is people who like that You Should Leave Tim Robinson show, and people who are angry that the editor of The Atlantic said that only white men can write cover stories. Like, I woke up the other day. Did you see this whole thing?
No, that's a real thing.
I mean, I'm paraphrasing, and I didn't actually read the original article. So, you know, listener beware of my description of this. But the sense I got was, I think it was the editor of The Atlantic. Well, actually, that's not true. Jonah Goldberg is not the editor of The Atlantic. It must have been a piece in The Atlantic where Jonah Goldberg was being interviewed. And
Jeffrey Goldberg is the editor of The Atlantic, Goldberg, according to something I'm looking at.
Okay,
now,
maybe it's Jeffrey Goldberg. Excuse me. And so, I'm going off of like one line that I just saw. I saw, like, I woke up and I saw all these people freaking out, and I didn't even know what they were freaking out about, but they were all talking about a bad take, and I didn't know what the take was. Have you ever had that experience where it's like,
yes, some,
in a matter of an hour, so the Twitter firestorm has moved past the original topic, and you don't even know what the thing they're upset about is, but because we're now having takes on the takes of the takes.
Yeah, some of the worst feelings I ever have is when I, and again, luckily I don't fall into this too much anymore, but it does happen from time to time. You wake up, you see one or somewhere between 1 and 400,000 references to something that somebody's upset about, and without even thinking about it, your brain starts going backwards. You start following threads backwards. Then you Google something, and then you've reconstructed some deconstructed take, and then you figure out why everybody is angry, and you don't feel any better about it. Again, not that I'm advocating us to keep our heads in the sand about things, but often I do this thing where I'll just see something, and then I have to sleuth it out, and then 5 minutes later, I guess I have my answer, but I don't feel better about it. In this particular case, I have the New York Times article here, and it's all covered right at the top. The headline is, "Writing cover stories is hard. For Atlantic editor, talking about diversity is harder. Jeffrey Goldberg, the editor-in-chief of The Atlantic, set off a storm of criticism on Thursday when he suggested that in seeking a diverse group of writers for cover stories, he found it difficult to hand those plum assignments to anyone other than white male magazine journalists. Quote, it's really hard to write a 10,000-word cover story, he said in an interview with the Nieman Lab. There are not a lot of journalists in America who can do it. The journalists in America who do it are almost exclusively white males. So that is,
yeah,
that at least answers the question of exactly what was said by
whom. I think it has to do, by the way, with the nature of how, like the emotional journey that we go on when we become enraged. And I'm not saying that the people who are mad about what he said or took issue with it were wrong, but it's, I know what you're saying, Andrew, which is like, if you get there, like if you arrive at the rage party late, it doesn't feel the same. It's not as fun because you haven't like, you didn't, I didn't like, because the way that you properly enjoy the rage party is you read a take like that from Jeffrey Goldberg. You just read it in the New York Times or you read it in wherever it was, a Neiman lab, and then you become angry at it. And then you go onto Twitter and you realize other people are angry about it. And you all hide, you get behind the couch and you get ready to yell, canceled, when the door of the apartment opens. And that's how you properly enjoy a rage party. But if you show up and they've already yelled canceled and everyone's just milling about drinking punch, and then you have to ask everyone person by person, hey, what are we doing here? What are we mad about? It just doesn't have the same emotional impact.
Yeah, I, of course, me, I would probably rather show up later. You know, I don't like big, you know, showy things like when everybody yells canceled. It's just a little bit much for me, but
sure.
I'm not like most people. But yeah, no, you're right. And again, just having read to you what I just read to you, obviously it's problematic. Obviously, it also just raises the question, like, how can you be smart enough to be the editor in chief of The Atlantic and then dumb enough to say something like that? But again, I've just read two sentences of a quote that I haven't read the rest of.
Still having not read the article, was that there was actually some more context to it. To your point, it's like the guy is the editor of The Atlantic, so he's probably got at least a couple marbles in his head. And I think that I can't tell you what that context was, but again, by the time I got to the rage party, I swear to God, it had gone from like, we all want to write cover stories and we can, and here's why this is a bad take. And then some people's take on the take was, well, there's more nuance to the take.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. So anyway, I'm not going to untangle that one, but I definitely know that feeling of, I will do it for jokes sometimes too. And again, kind of same deal. It doesn't usually pay off, but every now and then, you know who I do this a lot for? I probably shouldn't admit this, but like, because I don't pay attention to what's going on, like in the Twitterverse hardly at all anymore. In fact, I realized just I opened up Twitter and I was like, oh, I haven't opened up you in a couple of days. It's just kind of like, I don't know. I'm not living in that space at all anymore. But every now and then the stew bottle just tweets something out that is just kind of a very, very vague reference to something. But I obviously find him funny. So I will also kind of try to reconstruct people's jokes by working backwards, by like, you know, Googling whatever Stu wrote to see if any of those things are keywords that I should know about.
The StuBot also often changes, about every 2 or 3 months, changes his name on Twitter.
Yeah.
And that's usually some kind of deep, deep cut that I am typically not aware of. And I look at it and I go, I know that's a reference to something. I don't know what that something is.
I'll get my researchers on it when I get back home.
Exactly. Okay, before the break, I mentioned this surprise wedding that I'm here covering, I guess you could say, doing a story about. And I'll just say this. I think it's not as kooky an idea as maybe it sounds like. It's not as gimmicky as it might strike people just hearing surprise wedding. I mean, the basic deal was this couple that I met, they're really nice people, and they wanted to have all their loved ones at a thing that was going to, you know, announce and let everyone know they're getting married. But they didn't want to go through the months of like negotiating out all of the details of a wedding, like who's invited, who's not, who's what's going to be worn, what's happening with the various bachelor and bachelorette parties. They just didn't like – they didn't want to be – they wanted to just do what they wanted to do, but they didn't want to elope and just, you know, have a ceremony where there was nobody else there to witness it. So they were trying to figure out, how do we do this? And what they came up with was, well, we just won't tell people it's a wedding. We'll just invite everyone to a big engagement party. And then when they get there, we'll just say, actually, it's our wedding. And that's what they did. And it was actually pretty lovely. But this is the crazy part, Andrew. And I feel comfortable talking about this because, one, I have not identified who these folks are. And two, it could end up in the TV story, but I'm in a bit of a dilemma about if this should make it in or not. So they have everybody out to the thing. It's about maybe 45 minutes goes by. People are outside of this building socializing and just kind of hanging out, having a nice time. And then the bride and groom open the doors to the venue where the meal is going to be served. And there's a big sign that says, hey, surprise, we're getting married. And everyone goes, oh, wow, cool. People start clapping. And then everyone goes in and they have the wedding and then they have a meal. So we film all that, of course, and we need to then talk to some of the relevant parties. So that would be like people who seemed real surprised or the parents of the bride and groom. And we noticed that somebody who had a particularly strong reaction was the mother of the groom. She just looked kind of – she looked shocked and apoplectic in a way that was kind of funny to me. And we had it on camera, so I wanted to go talk to her. So she was I went up to her and I said, hey there, you know, we're with CBS and we're doing this story about surprise weddings. And is there any chance that we could chat with you a little bit? And she said, oh, I have to go. I have to take my husband home because he's having a medical procedure tomorrow. And I remember just thinking like, well, first I said to her, oh, well, can I just talk to you when you get back? And she goes, no, I'm not coming back. And then I was like, it just my brain was, and maybe you know what this is like, Andrew, as a producer, but my brain was just in kind of like producer mode of like, I must talk to these people before they leave, because if they leave and we don't interview them, then we won't have that footage. And they're like very relevant to this story. Like, hey, what did the parents think? So the woman was like, no, I can't really talk. And I was like, how about like we talk for 1 minute? And she was like, well, my husband's in the car. And she goes, we can talk by the car. So we go over and now we're in the parking lot of this thing. Instead of being like where the facility is, which is beautiful and nature-y, we're now in a random parking lot. And she goes and gets her husband out of the car and brings him around. And we're now standing in the parking lot. And what I realized midway through the interview with them is they are livid about this and they are leaving. They are not attending what is left of the surprise wedding. And somehow it so did not even occur to me that that could be their reaction. Like, I just thought that it would be like, at the worst, your parents might be like, what the heck? But then they just look around and they see the food and they see all the stuff and they're like, okay, well, now this is what's happening. Like, the idea of literally leaving the wedding, I could not even imagine that reaction. And so I didn't read any of the signs. The producer for the story later was like, I think they were leaving because they were upset. And I was like, no. The dad has a colonoscopy tomorrow. And she was like, yeah, tomorrow. Like, that makes no sense why you have to leave the wedding because of something that's an elective procedure that's happening tomorrow. Like, and then I went later and I talked to the groom and he was like, yeah, they're pretty mad. I figured they would be. And I was like, OMG. Like, no wonder they didn't want to talk. I just like cornered these parents in the parking lot who were literally leaving their child's wedding because they were mad at their child.
When you first started describing the situation, I kind of assumed that she was upset and that's why they were leaving, because they showed up for – did this happen at kind of near the beginning of the party too? Did they like show up? You get the big surprise and then they're like, all right, we're out of here. I was like, oh, something, this isn't going over super well. But is the tape of the groom saying how upset the parents are?
No. I was just chatting with him casually. Once I realized what was going on, I was not interested in trying to – photo and video document that part of it any longer. It's just weird to me that like I had a person in this guy's mother who was also saying, you know, everything she said when I looked at it interpreted it through the lens of, oh man, they're mad, made sense. She was like, we're shocked. I almost had a heart attack. I'm embarrassed of the outfit I'm wearing, like, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. It's like, oh, these are all the things you say when you feel like this came out of left field. But it's because I couldn't imagine even my parents, who I love and who are a little odd sometimes, I just can't imagine any parents having that reaction. Like, you might be – it might not have been exactly what you were hoping for, but you're there. You're there to come to a party. It's your kid. They're clearly happy. There's all this, you know, food and decorations set out. It's like – how do you not stay for that? Just, it was so hard for me to even imagine that I ignored like 35 obvious statements to the fact that they were pissed and leaving.
Yeah. I mean, well, a couple of things. First of all, it does kind of surprise me because you keep a good head on your shoulder, actually, when we're in situations where, like, because I'm very much like that. That would not surprise me to kind of miss something kind of big and obvious because I get into like producer brain mode, and I could definitely see that happening. I think that happens to you less. So I dig why you're kind of like a little bit dizzy from all of this. But to go back to the piece itself, not to totally miss your point, but to go back to the piece itself, like, it doesn't surprise me that the family would be really pissed, because for me, and this is, you know, I guess one of the million reasons why I wasn't interested in, like, kind of having a traditional marriage ceremony. Veeves and I, obviously not married, is because everybody does feel, especially parents often, this isn't for everybody, but especially parents and people close to the bride and groom, they feel so much ownership stake, or can feel so much ownership stake in your wedding ceremony, and maybe even in some cases your marriage. And I've seen, I've seen that become issues of tension for certain couples going through the whole nuptial process. So knowing that somebody, it does not surprise me that something like this would piss off a parent who would really probably, maybe her kid's entire life, she's been imagining what the special day could and should maybe look like. And then to show up and be like, wait, I'm wearing this dumb khaki dress. I have no idea. Assuming she wore a khaki dress. I don't even know what that means. Yeah. And just sort of feeling like you've lost a certain amount of control in this thing that was really important to you. It does not surprise me that somebody would be really upset. And now from kind of a storytelling point of view, I hope that you're able to work some of that into the story bluntly, because, I mean, there is something that I find, I don't know.
It's definitely more intriguing,
I don't want to be judgy,
right?
About,
it's more intriguing,
yeah,
than just, and it's more real. It's then that if, like, the story could be, and who knows, when this gets on TV, some of the listeners will see it, and I guess they'll make their judgment then. And I don't know if I'll win this argument, but right now, I don't know, maybe I won't have to, it won't be an argument. Maybe the editors will be happy for this to be in there, but I do kind of feel like it should be in the piece because it is journalistically really what did happen. But I also feel weird about it because, honestly, if I would have just seen the obvious thing, which was, these people are not leaving, because the thing was, a number of the people I talked to had kind of, like, this was a lovely event and people were lovely, but they're also, you know, you're going to get some oddballs. You're going to get some hop-ons. And I guess in my mind, I couldn't quite tell the line between people that just get nervous when the camera's on them or don't want to be on camera or are just have kind of odd personalities. I'd been sort of macheting through the jungle of that behavior already a bunch. And so someone being like, well, we got to leave for a colonoscopy tomorrow, it just sort of felt more like, oh, they're just being odd, rather than, oh, they're this mad about this that they're like, we will not stay 1 minute longer at this. But anyway, had I realized that, I would have never cornered them in a parking lot and made them do an interview. Like, I literally thought,
yeah,
oh, they're going to say something positive about this because it's their kid. They love their kid. So it's weird because had I realized what was going on, I would have never forced them to talk to me. But now that I did, it is now the most intriguing part of the whole story.
But it sounds like, again, kind of getting in the weeds on the story itself right now, you don't have anybody on tape actually saying, yeah, my parents or we are upset and we are leaving. So you'd almost have to go back and kind of like re-interview like the groom again, right? And be like, so what happened there? Like,
well, I mean,
I have
the parents talking about how not psyched they are. So there's that.
Oh, it does come off. I thought you were indicating that you were totally blind to it because they were just kind of like making excuses and not being honest about.
When we started talking, they kept saying things that, again, they kept saying things that were like, I don't know how I wasn't reading what was going on, but they were like, yeah, I almost had a heart attack. I'm still really weirded out by this. I can't believe I'm wearing this right now, et cetera, et cetera. They were literally just saying all this stuff that it's like, oh, no, these people are not happy with this. But I just thought they were trying to be funny or a little ironic or whatever. I don't know. But I do feel like, I don't want to make the piece negative at all because it was by and large really a beautiful thing and the majority of the people had fun. 50% of the parents involved really rolled with it, but 50% apparently did not.
I would also be grumpy if I had a colonoscopy scheduled the next day, I'll be honest with you. But I don't know. I think if the tape is good, I hope you're able to work it into the story because I think that's a much more complete story as opposed
yes.
to look at what young people are doing today. Like, isn't this an interesting trend and fad? Like, people – and I'm not even saying – obviously, I think the bride and groom, the people who are in the relationship, whoever they may be, should – make all of the decisions based on what works for them and their relationship, because that's what's important. But in a story like this, like, people do have stakes. And if you have the parents saying, like, yeah, this is this feeling like they were somehow, I don't know if disrespected is the wrong word, but maybe it's not the wrong word. Maybe they feel like they have, you know, a certain stake in their child's future because the way they raised them. I think that's way more interesting.
I mean, it's more real. It's what really happened. And also, by the way, the groom rolled with it. Like, the groom, part of why I got so confused was because the groom was, like, chatting with his mother and, like, saying, okay, mom, and, like, gave her a hug and stuff. So there was no, as they were kind of leaving, there was no indication. And he didn't, like, come up to me and go, like, hey, ixnay on the errand's pay. Like, there was... I guess what I was thinking is, like, if I was having my wedding and my parents were leaving, if you were just I'm not trying to say it was anyone's fault but my own for not reading the situation, but if my parents were leaving my wedding, you would read it on my face. There would be, I'd be like, what the F, you know? So it was also odd because, and to his credit, the groom just kind of rolled with it. Like, I think there was supposed to be a mother-son dance, you know, like how they do that with the
mother boy.
Yeah, there was supposed to be a mother boy.
Yeah,
and that obviously got scratched. That was the other. The producer and I were piecing together the mystery, and we were like, she was like, "Yeah, there's supposed to be on the schedule. There's listed a mother son dance. So that means that the departure of these parents was definitely not not part of the plan. Like that came out of nowhere, because otherwise there would not have been a mother son dance on the schedule, which of course did not." Right. Come to fruition.
By the way, I'm sorry if I'm a little distracted. I'm going to whisper here for a second. So, you know, you can picture my studio well, Luke. I'm up on on the second floor, essentially. So I never usually have the issue of people being right by my window while I'm recording. And I do have my window open today because, again, beautiful day in Seattle. Sorry you're not enjoying it in Cleveland. But I don't know what's going on. The building next to me is a salon, and it's a big flat roof. And somebody just set up a ladder. So this is maybe, I don't know, what do you think, 25 yards away from my open window, and they climbed up the ladder. Now there's two workers who are just like kind of hanging out outside my window. They've walked away for a moment. They're on the roof now. I don't know what they're doing, but we are like at a couple times just like locking eyes while they are talking to each other and I am talking to this microphone. I feel like I should probably close the window and maybe the drapes.
Can you? That looks more suspicious. Don't do that. Can you channel your inner Alice Springs, Australia, and just be like, hey, this is what I do. We're podcasters and we don't care who knows it.
That's right. This is my house. I mean, Alice Springs.
You do
Springs,
this
I
for
was,
your job. They should be impressed.
Area, yeah.
They should be asking for your autograph.
You know what? You're right. I'm taking my shirt off. Wait, did you say that?
No,
you didn't even say that. Sorry. I just moved like four steps ahead. Sorry. I don't even know where that came from.
Not say
wow. Anyway, sorry to change the subject. It was just I'll try to get a photo if I can. It was while we were talking, I realized part of my brain was also kind of like, I'm making eye contact with somebody who's standing on a roof looking at me right through my window right now.
Let's do some top stories real quick here. Please insert the top story sound effect in your own brain. I guess you can play it, Andrew. Should we?
I can. You want me to play it here?
Why not?
Here. I'm look it up in the book. Mm-hmm. I'm a professional. iTunes.
Hello and welcome to Top Story.
There is a law. If I can jump here quickly. When my iTunes sits there for a little bit, apparently sometimes it takes a while to wake up. And I will double click on an audio file to play it. And then it waits and it waits. And there must be some law, some word for the phenomenon that no matter how long I give it, as soon as I start talking to make an excuse for it, then the audio starts playing. This is not an issue that you have with your iTunes, is it?
Generally
speaking, delay,
no.
Lag.
That is, and I think it's probably because you're not on an Apple product.
Maybe, yeah. Huh. So anyway, sorry. Yeah.
By the way, hat tip to listener Michael for sending this in. I've talked a lot about the Impossible Burger and how excited I am that it's coming to Burger King, a.k.a. Bururé, a.k.a. Hungry Jack's, if you're in Australia.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact that the Burger King deciding to start selling these Impossible Burgers is put such a strain on the production. Oh, and that Impossible Foods, whatever the name of the company is that makes Impossible Burgers, I believe, I don't know if they had an IPO or if they just have been publicly offered, but I literally heard on the radio yesterday, by total coincidence, their stock was up like 40%. Because it's just everything's coming up plant-based. And the fact that Burger King is aligned with them means that there's like a run on these fake meat patties, so that other smaller places like the filling station in Bellingham that Carrie and I love to go to, the filling station doesn't even have them right now. Well, apparently even Burger King's don't have them right now. A Burger King in Brooklyn, this is as reported by Eater, has for weeks been filling seamless delivery orders for Impossible Whoppers with regular Whoppers and then just asking the seamless driver to inform the customers that they're getting a meat patty instead of an Impossible Burger. According to customers who talked to Eater, the drivers had not informed them that that was going on, and the receipt said Impossible Whopper. So, and by the way, the Impossible Whopper is only available in select cities. New York City is not one of them. So people have been going on to Seamless, ordering what they think is a plant-based burger from Burger King, having it delivered. I would like to question the life decisions that led you to order Burger King via Seamless, but I have ordered peanut M&Ms via Postmates, so I cannot judge anyone on those delivery decisions. But the idea that somebody would order this plant-based burger and then the local Burger King would say, we don't have that, but we'll just send out the regular Whopper and figure it'll be okay, is amazing to me. This is clearly a decision made by somebody who is not a non-meat eater, because the difference between a real Burger King Whopper and a Impossible Burger Whopper is a big difference if you don't eat meat.
Well, what is the logic here anyway? Let's say that you're not somebody who doesn't eat meat. Easier way to say that. Let's say that you are somebody who does eat meat,
for
and
which
you don't have
whom
a
meat is no longer not an option.
Right. So let's say that you have no moral obligation to eating meat. You have no health issues. You just ordered a hamburger, and then it arrived, and it was a chicken sandwich instead. And the driver is just supposed to tell you, by the way, we don't have any hamburger. We gave you a chicken sandwich instead. Even that isn't okay. Like,
right.
That is not how any of this works. That's not how any of this works. But then when you throw in the fact that, like, this isn't – I mean, obviously so many people who are not eating meat, it does have to do with, like, some – like dietary, like probably some in some situations serious dietary and certainly moral concerns. Like, how does this break down? This must have just been like the local manager of the BK teaming up with the local manager of Eater. Like you kind of indicated, these aren't probably the top scientists at either. I'm sorry, not Eater, but Seamless. These are probably not the highest paid positions in either of these organizations who came up with this solution.
Burger King has issued a statement that says basically, because of a technology error, one of our franchisees incorrectly listed the Impossible Whopper as a menu item at some New York area restaurants through two third-party delivery platforms. So basically, they accidentally listed it as a possibility as opposed to an impossibility, Andrew. They listed it as a possible thing you could order. And then when people ordered it, then what they should have done, or at least the person working at the BK, what they should have done is said, oh, no, we don't have that. Instead, they sent out a meat burger hoping like nobody would notice, basically. But it has now apparently been the error has been fixed. BK says that they will, of course, refund the money to people for their – I mean, that's always – by the way, when it comes to fast food, I feel like this idea that like, oh, if there was a problem with your 99-cent chicken sandwich, you can come in and get a refund. Like that's the perfect crime on the part of the fast food restaurant, because I'm never going back to the fast food restaurant to get my 99 cents. I don't mean I won't eat there again. I probably will eat there again, but I will have forgotten about the 99 cents. Like if a place messes up your order or if there's some kind of like system-wide recall – but it's for under $2, I'm probably not going to take advantage of that. Meaning Burger King is probably getting away with something here, because I doubt anyone's going to go and get their free meatless Whopper in 3 months when they're actually available.
Well, Yeah, and you know me, like I'm a meat eater to a fault, literally. You are somebody who doesn't eat meat, but it's, you know, that's a newer thing in your life, and I think that you try really hard, at least outwardly, to kind of be as chill about it as possible. As far as I know, I don't think you did end up having to eat any meat in our Australia trip, but you did say a couple of times leading up to it, like, well, God, if there's literally nothing else, I might have to eat meat, and it sounded like something that you could do if you absolutely had to.
Sure.
But there are other people who are like, I mean, the idea of them, like, if they ate this thing and they're like, and it's their first Impossible Burger, which all we hear about is how realistic it is and how it's got, you know, it actually emulates a burger in so many ways, even down to, like, the kind of the blood or juiciness, for lack of a better word. And I can imagine somebody waking up and just being like, gee, they eat that thing. They think it was an Impossible Burger. They're impressed with the technology. And then they find out, wait a second, I just ate a cow. And like some people, as you know, Luke, we know some of these people. I mean, that could literally make somebody sick. First of all, it can make somebody sick even if you don't know. If you're somebody who hasn't eaten any kind of animal product in a really, really long time, I think just introducing that to your system can be a shock. But also, even in hindsight, being somebody who just like really, really sees very little difference between humans and animals as far as life forms are concerned, and you've given maybe all of your life or adult life to having a certain relationship with animals that includes not eating them. Like, I just think this is really serious, or could be serious for some folks. And again, I'm not one of those folks. I'm a meat eater.
Yeah, I'm with you. You're right, though, that I'm always struggling to balance the fact that I don't want to personally eat meat with not being... I want to try to not sound too judgy, although this is the weird thing. And let me just... Oh, my God. I can't... Nope. I'm not going to do it. I'm not going to go there. What I'm trying to say is I don't ever want to be judgy, but on the other hand, if I honestly believe that it's not cool to, like, kill animals and eat them, I probably should be more adamant. You know what I mean? Like, I don't ever want to bum anyone out, and I'm like, well, I'm just... It's just what I'm doing, which is true, but then it's like... If I actually think it's an important principle, I wonder maybe I should advocate. Don't worry, I'm not going to, because I do find that I know that like people have a really strong reaction. I think some people have a really strong reaction to people being a vegetarian or a vegan, and I think it comes from a sense that vegetarian or vegan person is going to start giving them grief about what they're doing. And so people sometimes I think have almost like a pre-response to it where they'll make the argument as to why the person who doesn't eat meat is being preachy or whatever, or it doesn't have it figured out right. Like, and I definitely don't want to be that preachy person. But on the other hand, it's like, yeah, I don't know. If I think it's an important thing, I wonder, maybe I should go a little harder with it. Anyway, yeah, it's a bad story all around. There's no indication anyone's suing Burger King. Who knows how many people actually got these real burgers that were supposed to be fake burgers. But yeah, I would be bummed out about it. I'd be so bummed out, I would throw the burger away. I would complain about it to you on the show, and I would never go back and get my refund. That's how mad I would be.
Right, yeah. Yeah, of course, you're somebody who I guess would notice the difference.
Maybe, but you're also right. Some people, yeah, if they've never had an Impossible Burger before, they're like, holy mackerel, they've done it. This tastes exactly like a Whopper.
Yeah, I do wonder, though, you know, I've portrayed this imaginary person who accidentally ate this as somebody who has been a lifelong or most of their lifelong vegetarian who has these huge, you know, kind of moral issues with eating meat and everything. Chances are those folks, for the small number of people who probably got this non-Impossible Burger, probably the people I'm describing are not super interested in eating something that is marketed as being super like animal product. You know what I mean? They've probably got their own routine down that they're not craving an Impossible Burger. I feel like Impossible Burgers are more appealing to people like me who still enjoy eating meat but understand why maybe it's better to eat more plant-based stuff, or people like you who recently gave up meat and still have a craving for a certain texture that you're used to, as opposed to people... I think you get to a level of vegetarianism where you're not really craving fake meat, right?
Are you asking me if... I would imagine that does happen. I am still... I don't personally crave meat that much, but I'm definitely in the camp of people who... are interested in eating things that are meat-like. For instance, last night when I went to this place, Town Hall, here in Cleveland, I had a stir fry, kind of a Thai peanut deal with like fake chicken in it. But I have to admit, the fake chicken was so convincing that I got worried they had messed up the order and given me real chicken, and I had to double check with them. And then when I found out it was in fact the like vegan fake chicken product, I was extremely excited. So I clearly still, on some level, enjoy eating something that is like the flesh of an animal, even though it's not made from the flesh of an animal. This next story about robocalls was interesting to me because I have been getting so many like spam calls on my phone, Andrew, and they all come from a version of my actual cell phone number, but like one digit off. And I could not for the longest time figure out what was going on. Also, there's always the chance I could have a bill collector calling me. So, you know, sometimes if I see a weird call, I'm like, uh-oh, did Diamond Parking Lot catch up with me? What's going on here? Well, it's not... If you're like me, if you've been getting a lot of robocalls, it is not your imagination. They're up 46% from last year. And so the FCC has now changed the rules so that cell phone companies can actually legit block a robocall as opposed to just telling you it's possible spam. The concern around blocking robocalls is that sometimes, like a call from a hospital or your bank, comes in via a system that your phone could read as a robocall, and they think it's dangerous to block that. Although it's kind of like, I don't know, like how many, like the chances of that happening are relatively slim. The chances of me getting robocalled are relatively high, in that every day, Andrew, I probably get 10 of them. And I also found it very somehow reassuring to know that what's happening on my phone is a real thing. It's called neighborhood spoof. That's a pretty good spoof, where somehow the software that's robocalling you knows to basically use your number but like one or two digits off, because they think you're more likely to answer it if it's from your own number, which is also weird to me. Like, are you calling from the future? I would not answer the phone if it was me calling, because frankly, I'm boring. I know this because I've been living with myself for 43 years. But I guess they think that you're more likely to pick it up if it looks familiar. And so
I think it was my – I had read about this a while back, and my understanding was that also – and I think this preys on probably older people too, and maybe even people who are used to a more of a landline system, that if it looks local, you don't think it's your own phone calling you, but it's just like, oh, this must be in my neighborhood. This is like – it just feels kind of like, oh, this might be somebody who's literally like – I don't know, a neighbor or something, which is, it doesn't really make sense on paper, but there's just this split second moment in your brain where it just seems to make sense. Again, especially if you're somebody who is kind of used to the, like landlines and more of a neighborhood kind of communication system.
Yeah, I think you're exactly right. For me, it's weird because I don't live, my cell phone is, you know, the area code is from Los Angeles because that's where I lived when I got it. Well, that's where I lived when NPR gave me a cell phone that had that number that I then never gave back to them. They are not paying the bill on it. I had to port the number. But, you know, our cell phone numbers are really the thing that establishes now our identity and our history as people. So you see someone, you're like, oh, a 312, Chicago, what's up? Like, and so because I got this is the cell phone that I had at the time when I put all my contacts in my phone and everybody else I knew got cell phones. This was the time when we all started communicating via cell phone. So I was like, I'll be damned if I'm going to lose this number. Lukey, Don't Lose That Number, I believe, is the song I'm thinking of.
Lukey.
Do you know the woman who, Ricky, Don't Lose That Number? That woman, Ricky, lives in Port Townsend. Carrie and I know her.
No, the person who the song is about?
Yeah, the person that the song is about, Ricky, Don't Lose That Number, is a woman who lives in Port Townsend. Her name is Ricky.
No, I didn't know that. I don't even know who does the original song. I'm looking
it's
it
like
up.
Steely
in, here,
Dan
you know,
or
oh,
something?
That's Steely Dan. I would have never guessed that. Okay, interesting.
Yeah. Anyway, it's weird to me when the number comes up, but you're right. I don't live in that area anymore, but that I'm sure is what it's doing. It's just trying to get me. A lot of times, by the way, these calls now, if they do leave a message or if the robot leaves a message, it'll be in like Mandarin, which I just feel like, you guys, I mean, you're so far off the mark here. Like, you left me a 2-minute message in Mandarin. And I know that it doesn't matter. They're just blasting as many people as they can. But I'm like, if you had any chance of scamming me, you really missed. Like, once you started leaving me a message in Mandarin, you have greatly overestimated my polyglot tendencies.
Right. Well, I – okay. So – Really quickly here, I got a phone call moments before you dialed me up to do the show today, and it was, again, one of those neighborhood spoof calls. I get these. You say you get about 10 a day. I get one to two of these a day. I should actually go back in my records and see if that's accurate. I know I get at least one a day. And so I also have a number from a out-of-town area code, New Hampshire, and then the next three digits, often it'll come from the next three digits as well, and then the last four digits are different than my own. And I've known about this neighborhood scam for a long time. Sometimes I pick up, though, just to get it to stop ringing. And one thing that I'll do is I'll pick it up and I'll put the phone to my ear without saying hello, just to kind of hear what's going on. Nine times out of ten, it then just hangs up on me because I don't say hello. And yeah. I'm wondering if part of the system also is just kind of figuring out which of these numbers are live. So by the very nature of me picking up the phone and or, you know, picking up the line when it's ringing, now whatever robot out there knows that there's a living person at the other end of this number. So therefore, I'll stay on the list. I have no idea if that's true or not, whatever. But today I pick up the phone when it's ringing, one of these spoof numbers, and I don't say anything, but as I'm picking it up and putting it to my ear, I hear somebody on the other end say, "Hello," as if I was calling them and not saying hello, or I missed them saying hello a couple of times. And I'm wondering if that was a robot voice, kind of, because I had this human reaction. I was like, "Oh, hello, is somebody there?" And then it hung up on me. And is there a chance that these spoofers actually know that I will have a reaction to that, and they have a electronic recording of somebody saying in a somewhat confused, put-out way, "Hello," on the other end?
I 100% think that's a possibility. And like, wow. Listen, you patented this move, Andrew, when you were a telemarketer.
Yes.
And you would say, "Hey,
yes.
what was your thing again you would do?"
Oh, this is classic. So you're supposed to say, when somebody picks up, "Hi, this is Andrew Walsh calling from EBSCO Telemarketing about your Field & Stream magazine." That was, like, I think legally what you're supposed to say too. Like, you have to make yourself known very quickly.
Sure.
In the call, I would do this thing where, well, let's just role play it. So you're at home, the phone rings. Ring, ring.
Okay. Hello?
Oh, hi, Luke.
Yeah.
Hey, this is Andrew Walsh from your Field & Stream magazine.
I'm
telling you, Luke, it's that pause.
God.
It's that pause. Hey, it's Andrew Walsh. And it's just like, I just felt like it put that other person on their heels for 1 second, being like, wait, Andrew, is this my son-in-law? Wait a second. This isn't my son-in-law, Andrew. And for that split second, I feel like I could either.
Is this my son who recently had a surprise wedding who I haven't talked to for 2 years?
And now he's trying to sell me a Field & Stream magazine that I haven't gotten in 3 years, and he's calling it a renewal? This is bullshit. Anyway, some people, I think that I sometimes got a foot in the door by doing that weird thing. I think other people I pissed off more than I would have if I had just been straight up, because I think that moment of confusion, then they feel flustered, then they realize that they've been had. I don't encourage telemarketers to do what I did, but I was pretty proud of it as a young salesman.
All right, before we get out of here, let me just mention that Bushwick Bill has passed away. Sadly, he was 52 years old. Andrew, he, of course, was one of the guys in Ghetto Boys. He had cancer and was, I think, on tour and had to cancel a show because even though he was ill, he was still trying to kind of get out there and tour and make money. And I think he was talking about, If his health would have held out a little longer, he was going to try to do a tour and donate some of the proceeds to pancreatic cancer, which is what he passed away from. Mind Playing Tricks on Me is not just a song we used extensively during our Halloween show. It is a all-time favorite of mine. I didn't know this, but Bushwick Bill, he was actually born in Jamaica. He, of course, was born with dwarfism. He stood 3'8" tall. The Ghetto Boys were actually picked up by Rick Rubin, their big album was one that he helped produce. Their album We Can't Be Stopped. I think we must have talked about the cover of this album. I'm kind of obsessed with it. It's from 1991, and it's a picture of Bushwick Bill being wheeled into the emergency room for some sort of surgery because he had apparently injured himself, I think, with a gun at one point. I mean, he dealt with drug problems and other things. And someone took a picture of him being wheeled in. He's talking on a cell phone, and it's one of those, like, Gordon Gekko ridiculous 90s cell phones as he's being wheeled on a gurney. It's just, like, an iconic photo. Have you seen this picture?
Yeah, you've talked about it a lot. I always associate you with – because I really love that song, too. I don't know much by the Geto Boys. They also did what is their second biggest hit?
I'm trying to figure out. I honestly don't know. As I was reading this,
maybe,
to be honest with you, I always thought they were kind of a one-hit wonder. They had that song. But, you know, the New York Times really gave him this obituary. It really kind of fleshes out his career and kind of how seminal and important Geto Boys were. And like I said, the Rick Rubin element is something because, you know, Rick Rubin is kind of a legendary producer. Like, they were really a pretty important hip-hop act from Houston. And to some degree, Bushwick Bill continued to be relevant. I think he was on a Dre album not that long ago. I would say for me, yeah, he was on the Chronic. I guess that was 92. God, Andrew, why are we so old? He also, this was the part that jumped out at me, though. At one point, he renamed himself. Bushwick Bill renamed himself, and his new name was Dr. Wolfgang von Bushwicken the Barbarian Motherfunk Stay High Dollar Billster.
Oh.
So if you were thinking of changing your name to that, Andrew, it was taken.
That's the opposite of an Australian nickname. Instead of shortening it and just adding O, they've just added a million words and syllables to that.
His name would be, if he was Australian, he'd be like Billo. But instead, he's Dr. Wolfgang von Bushwicken the Barbarian Motherfunk Stay High Dollar Billster.
O. You just throw an O on the end of that one. By the way, Damn It Feels Good to Be a Gangsta is the other song that everybody knows. Yes, because I was in the back of my head. I had this memory of driving through L.A. listening to a Geto Boys song, which, there's the fantasy in there. I love how they deal in fantasy so much in their songs, in the two songs that I know, about, like, being in the White House, being, like, the first black president or something along those lines. I think there's a verse in there in that song, and I just remembered that. But, I don't have it in front of me. I don't know if you do, Luke. I know that you're traveling sans printer, but I loved the first line in the article that you sent. And was it a New York Times obituary that does something about the
John
way they described
John Caramonica
the
writing. What's that?
Yeah. Yeah, do you have it there? Because I just called it up. Yeah,
sure.
Go ahead.
Bushwick Bill, who helped inject vivid psychological horror and lightly morbid comedy into Southern hip hop storytelling and became one of the genre's most recognizable characters, died on Sunday at a Colorado hospital. Yeah, that's an interesting way to describe kind of what the vibe was of Geto Boys and particularly of Bushwick Bill.
I mean, I literally still get chills after the last stanza Mind playing tricks on me when you realize, oh, it hasn't been Halloween all along.
His mind
was like,
that's the original M. Night Shyamalan story.
Yes, it is. Like he's literally on the ground punching the pavement because he thinks he's fighting somebody. And then suddenly the song ends with this realization that there's nobody there. He's just slamming his fists into the pavement, fighting a ghost.
Yeah,
and it's not even Halloween.
That line is literally cited in this article. The song is alarmingly spooky, and Bushwick Bill's verse, which comes last, described a disturbing hallucination that he was being attacked while out trick-or-treating. The more I swung, the more blood flew. Then he disappeared, and my boys disappeared too. Then I felt just like a fiend. It wasn't even close to Halloween. So there you go. That line also made a big impression on the guy writing in the New York Times.
Yeah, so good. I mean, honestly, I get a little chill at that line, even knowing it's coming in the same way that, like, thinking about, like, other creepy stories and movies can give me a chill. That is really good. And, again, those are the two songs that I've listed everything that I know by the Geto Boys, and I clearly can't even remember the names of them at the top of my head. But, good stuff. And this is I like this John Caramonica guy. He really captures it.
He writes a lot of good stuff about music for the Times. Should we go out with that song? I know we've played it a lot on the show, but it just feels like
we should.
If there's a day for it, I guess it would probably be today. Maybe we should.
It's not Halloween.
Well, that's the thing. I'm going to go outside.
It's the perfect day for it.
And I'm going to go outside and remember it's not Halloween, quite to my horror. I assume there's a clean version because we've played the song so many times on the show. There must be. Oh, hey, by the way, a little breaking news here. I don't have my breaking news sound effect, so I guess we're just going to use this one. There was an earthquake here in the Cleve that happened as we were starting the show, and I did not even realize it was happening. Carrie said, texted me, did you feel the earthquake? And I said, no. Apparently a 4.0 on the Richter scale earthquake shook the Cleve while I was doing the show.
Now I'm interested in seeing, is there, like, four is not huge by West Coast standards, but they're more rare in the Midwest, correct?
Yeah. Residents across the area reported feeling an earthquake. The U.S. Geological Survey gave the quake a preliminary rating of a 4.0 magnitude. Which I think is probably not that high on the Richter scale, but for out here, that's a big deal.
Mm-hmm. Looks like it's on the east side, too. You might have even felt it more had you been there on the east side where I thought you were staying, in like Willoughby Hills or wherever it was. But
Chardon.
Interesting. Well, I'm glad you're alive.
Yep, Chardon. I made it, guys. I'm a survivor. And I'm going to keep on making it down to Austin. And then, I didn't even lay out my week as if the listeners care. But maybe you care, Andrew, because some of this is relevant to your professional interests. So Austin tonight and tomorrow. And then tomorrow night I fly to Portland. And then Wednesday, I'm doing this event that I'm actually pretty excited about. I don't know if it's sold out. I don't know what the story on the tickets is, but it's an onstage interview with Pete Holmes because he's written a book, and it's at the Helium Comedy Club. And so I'm going to do that. I think we're going to use some of the recording eventually as LiveWire content, but it's not an episode of LiveWire. It's just me and Pete Holmes. He's also not doing stand-up. It's just me, Pete Holmes, on stage talking. And then on Thursday night, I'm doing LiveWire, and Kamau Bell is one of the guests, which will be fun. And then on Friday, I'm coming by your house and doing the show there. So I will be home at some point in the distant future.
Okay, yeah, no, that sounds good. And also then, we have a date at KUOW on Friday.
Yeah, it's exciting. Good. We're going to be...
All right.
I don't know. Here's the thing. I don't want to mention the show that we're helping out with because I feel we might screw it up, our appearance on the show, and they might not be able to use it. And I don't want to paint them into a corner with this. But let's just say
You
and I are doing something on Friday that for both of us, I think, represents a high degree of difficulty.
As a matter of fact, I raised it here on the show now, and I didn't even mean to do that. I was just like talking like word diarrhea. but I mentioned to our buddy Durs, who works at KUOW, that I might be swinging by next week, and he said, "What are you up to?" And I said, "Management." And he's a producer on one of the Drive Time magazine shows there. And I said, "Management asked me to come in and audit all the producers, make sure they're doing their jobs." Emphasis on Drive Time magazine shows. I'll just be following you around with a clipboard and grading you on work ethic, grit, and pluckiness. So if Durs asks, that's what we're doing at KUOW on Friday.
I'm into it. Well, first, it starts with leave a thumb drive in the parking lot and see if he picks it up.
Yeah,
do that this week. And then on Friday, we can analyze if he did the right thing or not.
Yeah, I'm going to scatter a whole bunch. All right, that's a good idea.
All right, I guess let's call that a day here for this imaginary radio program. But good news for all of you, or bad news, I don't know. I don't know your life. We're going to be right back here tomorrow with more imaginary radio. So why don't you join us for that? Until then, enjoy your Monday. Enjoy the sunshine if you're in the Northwest, or the rain shine if you're here in the Cleve. We'll see you tomorrow morning. Until then, go Mariners, go win a milking contest, and please remember, no mountain too tall.
And good luck to all.
I start sweating, and blood starts coming out my nose. It's somebody watching the act, but I don't know who it is, so I'm watching my back. I can see him when I'm deep in the covers. When I awake, I hear a car burning rubber. He owns a black hat like I own. A black suit and a cane like my own. Some might say take a chill, B, but I can't, G, cause there's somebody trying to kill me. I'm popping in the clip when the wind blows. Every 20 seconds got me peeping out my window. Investigating the joint for traps. Checking my telephone for taps. I'm staring at the woman on the corner. It's messed up when your mind is playing tricks on you.
This year, Halloween fell on a weekend. Me and Ghetto Boys are trick-or-treating. Robbing little kids for bags. Till an old man got behind our rags. So we speeded up the pace. Took a look back, and he was right before our face. We were in for a squab, no doubt. So I swung and tried to take him out. He was going down, we planned. But this wasn't no ordinary man. He stood about 6 or 7 feet. Now that's the creep I be seeing in my sleep. So we triple teamed on him. Dropping them fifth ward bees on him. The more I swung, the more blood flew. Then he disappeared and my boys disappeared too. Then I felt just like a fiend. It wasn't even close to Halloween. It was dark as death on the streets. My hands were all bloody from punching on the concrete. Aw, man, homie. My mind is playing tricks on me. Playing tricks on me.
Power out.